The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
The following is brought to you in part by MFC Studios. The views and opinions of the show's hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect those of the owners, management, or staff of WGBB. And now, it came from the radio.
Hello and welcome once again to It Came From The Radio. This is Joel Moore, Toro speaking. With me in the studio, I have a very cool guest sitting in with us for the whole hour. It's Arlen Schumer. Say hi, Arlen.
Hey, Mark.
And on the phone, we have Hassan or Charlie? We have Charlie. We have Charlie on the phone. Our senior correspondent, Charlie Saladino. Say hi, Charlie.
Hey, how's everybody over there?
Doing all right. And we also have Brian, the engineer, behind the booth as usual. Hassan Godwin is busy fighting dragons in the Bronx, so he might not be calling in this week. So Charlie, how are you doing?
Oh, pretty good. He might be fighting lightning dragons because thunderstorms are threatening up here. I don't know how it is in the Bronx.
Not good.
I'm doing good. How's everything with you, Mark?
I'm doing quite well. We actually have a unique show this week. We're going to have a full hour with Arlen because Arlen has a tremendous amount of stuff to talk about. And I met him like 5-6 years ago. No, before that.
Cause I think longer.
It was when this was first coming out.
Right.
So that was about
2003. That was 03 or 04, yeah.
And I've known him for quite some time, and he keeps on having so much more stuff. Every time I talk to him, he's always doing something and whatnot, so we're going to do that. So if anybody's having any trouble listening to us on the air, you can go online to www.am1240wgbb.com. Listen to us on the live audio streaming. Also on the GBB website, you can see us right now in the live definition web camera right now, waving hi. That's provided that you're listening to us live, unless you're listening to us on the archives, which will be watching something else if you go to the website. So there will be no news this week. We're just going to take away straight with Arlen. But first, I want to mention we had the contest last week for the World's Not As Easy As It Once Was Before contest. The song that was played was Ultraman, Towards the Future. And they got the person who won was Alfredo Harris Jr. He won 2 tickets to the New York Comic Con on Thursday the 9th, right? I'm getting confirmation it's the 9th, it's Thursday?
Yes,
Thursday the 9th, so congratulations to him. And the show is brought to you in part by the Red Bastards at Belmore Towing, located in Belmore, New York. Always happy to take care of your any of your towing needs, such as charging you $50 for a $7 lug nut.
Hey, is that legal, Mark?
Yes, it is very legal. It's unethical, but it's legal business practices. And, of course, the movie that's going to be coming out to a theater near you soon, Abraham Lincoln, Monkey Vampire Killer, which Abraham Lincoln comes out of retirement to fight the evil vampire Monkey King riding on sharks.
And you could get a 10% discount if you, instead of buying popcorn, go in with a banana.
Yay! It's bring your own banana.
It's bring your own banana.
Is
movie.
That a banana in your hand, or are you just happy to see me?
So let's just start off with our guest. So, Arlen, why don't you tell everybody who you are and how did you come to be a part of this whole wealth of information I have in front of us?
Well, I'm an artist. I was trained at Rhode Island School of Design as a graphic designer, but I've made my living more as an illustrator, but working in a comic book art style. And by doing that all these years of my career, I also, as a lover of comic book art, I mean, I grew up with it. It really taught me everything I know about art. I don't think you can love an art form like comics without becoming interested in the history of it. So I think I became just an historian just because I love the history. And I imagine people that grow up with music, you know, get into the history, or they become critics. I know Chrissy Hynde of the Pretenders was a music critic before she became the Pretenders. So I think this happens with a lot of people, and, you know, rock and roll in general started out as fans writing about it, and now when you pick up a newspaper, a magazine, you know, everybody's got a rock and roll reviewer. So it started out as a fan-based thing. So I was always interested in the history of comics, and I started to develop lectures about it. But I always wanted to do a coffee table art book about the history of comics, that the history that I grew up with, which is the Silver Age or the 1960s. Most books about the history of comics were about the Golden Age or the 1940s when the whole superhero thing started. And I was never a big fan of the Golden Age. I mean, I was interested in it because that's where Batman and Superman started. But the artwork was crude. I came of age in the 1960s when I feel the superhero art of the DC and Marvel comics I was reading really reached its kind of apogee, its mature level. When you talk about those great artists like Jack Kirby, Gil Kane, Joe Kubert, Carmine Infantino, all those artists reached their mature styles during the 1960s and the Silver Age. So when I would look out on the landscape, there were no books about that part of the history. And not only that, but most books about comic book history were text heavy with miniature reproductions. I think a whole generation, and to this day, people get drawn, pun intended, into comics because of the visuals. It's a visual medium. Yes, the words and the scripts are important, but you can't stand there in the comic book store and read the stories, although, as you know, a lot of people do. The point is you are drawn in by the art. You're taken through a comic book story by the artwork. And then, of course, you read the story, and sometimes the story's good or not good or whatever. But that's what draws us to comics. And those great artists that I talked about are the reasons why we're in a renaissance now of all these movies, because they all come out of characters from the Silver Age. But yet all of them are because of the artists who drew them. The average moviegoer seeing the Avengers may not know the name Jack Kirby. But without Jack Kirby, there would be no Avengers, because, again, it's the visuals of these characters that make them these icons that result in these movies. When I was a kid, we knew that if Hollywood took superheroes seriously like we took them seriously, like the artists and writers took them seriously, they would be great movies. It only took about 40 years for that to happen. But like a whole generation had to die off that thought comics were junk or that they could only be treated, you know, campily like the Batman TV series. That generation had to die off. The generation that's greenlighting all these movies now is the generation, in a sense, that came out of the Silver Age, that loves comics, knows their great stories, knows that these characters are visually based, and that's why we're in a renaissance now with no end in sight. I mean, Marvel has their movies planned out, I think, for the next 20 years.
Yeah.
But in terms of my book, so I finally, it took me 25 years, my original ideas for the book started when I was a senior at Rhode Island School of Design, majoring in graphic design. By the way, I went to RISD because Walt Simonson, the great Marvel Comics artist, came out of there when I was in high school with this like revolutionary drawing style and a kind of a design sense. And at the time, I'm in high school thinking I was going to be a comic book artist. And I thought to myself, boy, if they could turn out a guy like Walt Simonson, that's where I want to go. So the initial ideas of a book about comic book history from the 1960s started when I was a senior at RISD, and I just kept developing those ideas over time while I was having my illustration career and my other things, living in New York City and whatever, doing things I'm doing. But I always wanted to do this book about the Silver Age and make it more about the art with the text being supplementary. I finally got to do it in 2003 with a small publisher in Oregon. They were like a mom and pop, and the book came out. But, you know, 2003 was before Facebook, before really these superhero movies really hit big, which, again, the characters are all out of the Silver Age. So my book came out, but it didn't get a lot of publicity and promotion because it was a mom and pop publisher. And then a year after the book came out in 2005, the publisher went belly up. So the book's been out of print ever since. So all these past years, I kept wanting to bring the book back into print. But I didn't have an agent, and without an agent, you know, it's tough to get a publisher. And I spent these last bunch of years trying to get it republished, but to no avail. By the way, to no avail is a classic comic book expression. I mean, my whole vocabulary comes out of comic books, which again...
So you're a walking comic book encyclopedia.
Walking and talking, absolutely. But you know what I mean? When I think of to no avail, if you grew up reading comics, you knew words and expressions when you were 8 years old that no other eight-year-old knew. You know, Batman, I remember, had a villain named Mr. Incognito. Now, that's a Latin word, which means disguise. What other eight-year-old knew incognito? But, you know, the words we were taught, like origin. I mean, there are adults that don't know what the word origin means. You know, DC had a Plastic Man knockoff character named the Elongated Man. I mean, elongated? So, you know what I'm saying? So,
yeah.
So the point is that with the growth of both Facebook giving me a base now to operate out of, where I now am hearing from people across the country and even the world in England that either saw my book 10 years ago or know about my other book, the Twilight Zone book. So that combined with the growth in self-publishing enabled me to make the decision late last year that, you know what, I don't have to wait for a mainstream publisher to kind of pat me on the head and say, yeah, Arlen, we want to do your book. I can do it myself. And through Facebook, because I started not only a group about Neil Adams, one of the great artists in my book, but I recently started a Silver Age group on Facebook. The two of them have 2,500 members, and it's given me now a base that I can reach the people that are going to love the book. And then on top of it, all these years later, now I can have an ebook version as well. You know, I had to go back to DC and Marvel, the lawyers, and negotiate the rights for the ebook, because back when my book was first published, even though I had the right to reprint, there was no clause about an ebook because nobody was doing ebooks in 2003.
See, you got to have that hindsight, the foresight.
Of course, but again, in 2003, nobody was even talking about what an ebook was. It wasn't even in the original contract. So I'm really excited not only to be bringing the book back out in a revised hardcover. I got the chance to revise all the typography in the book. Now, typography is a kind of invisible art. I mean, unless you're a graphic designer, no type. When type is working well, it's kind of invisible. You shouldn't notice it.
It's like editing.
Exactly. But when it's bad, you may not be able to articulate why you're looking at something, you don't like it, but bad type brings down good art. When I put my book out originally, the deadline was so severe, I had to hire freelancers to help me with the type. I mean, I designed it all, but they had to execute, and I'm a perfectionist. I'm proud of it. It's a blessing and a curse, because I'm also up till 4 a.m. fixing things, because that's the blessing and curse of being a perfectionist. But revising the book, I was able to go back literally every page. The type now, I was satisfied with the original type about 60%. So now the type is perfect, and I'm excited about that. And there's a couple of graphic surprises in the revised hardcover that even for fans out there that have the original book, I think they might want to still buy the revised version because of these graphic surprises that I don't want to reveal. I want them to be surprises, but I will say I will double your money back if not satisfied.
That's a sales pitch if I ever heard one.
Hey, we got to sell our stuff, right?
You mentioned Twilight Zone. Now, I know, Charlie, you love Twilight Zone, right?
Oh, yes, definitely.
So what do you have with the Twilight Zone book that you have right over there across the table? You have something about Twilight Zone also. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, my very first book came out in 1990 with Chronicle Books. They're a very mainstream publisher of coffee table pop culture books in San Francisco. And my first drive, while I still had this idea of doing a comic book history book, I was also a fan of the Twilight Zone. The very first image I saw as a child when I was 5 years old was the image of the eyeball in outer space in the 1963 opening. Now, think about that. The eye is the symbol of art, vision. The word video means I see in Latin. So my first image as a child that I can remember is the eyeball. And then I become an artist, and I end up doing a coffee table art book based on the TV series. What I did was, as soon as I got out of RISD, I was working in New York City, at the public television, say WNET in New York City. That was my first job out of art school.
Yeah, all right.
Doing television graphics. And at the time, the only book about the making of a television show was The Making of Star Trek. When you go into a bookstore now, there's an entire television section. But back in 1980, there was one book about a TV show. So I'm working in New York City and doing TV graphics, and I read somewhere that Bantam Books is coming out with a book on the making of The Twilight Zone. Well, like a comic book thought balloon over my head, I had the idea, I've got to become the art director of that book. Now, I had never art directed a book, but I just knew that I had graphic ideas, because in the late 70s, video art was just coming in. When I was at RISD, I started to see exhibitions and articles and gallery shows where artists were kind of manipulating images behind the TV set and photographing the TV screen and treating it like art.
Right.
And I thought to myself, you know, whenever I used to flip around the dial, you knew when you landed on Twilight Zone, even though there were other black and white TV shows, there was something about the look of the Twilight Zone that was unique. So when I saw this video art, I thought to myself, you know, I bet you if I just took pictures of Twilight Zone episodes and treated them like art, they would be art. Because again, black and white art photography was just coming into its own in the late 70s. I think the Museum of Modern Art started their photography collection in the late 70s. Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run album cover appearing in 1975 also, believe it or not, gave a jump start to black and white art photography. Because if you think back to the early 70s, most of the great album covers were, you know, Roger Dean's Yes albums. They were paintings, they were surreal imagery, but it was full color. You know, the Beatles and Sgt. Pepper and stuff like that. So black and white art photography starts coming in the late 70s, video art. And when I hear that Bantam is going to do a book, I stay late at Channel 13 and I stay up late at night and I start photographing. I set up a Nikon camera in front of my TV screen, and WPIX in New York used to show The Twilight Zone every night at midnight. I would watch every episode, and I took pictures of whenever I saw an image that I just thought looked cool. And I put together like a little proposal, and I sent it to Bantam Books with a cover letter saying, I heard you're doing a book. I would love to be the art director. Well, they sent the proposal right back with a letter saying, sorry, Mr. Schumer, but we're going to do the book in-house. And I was like, and I remember talking to a friend at Channel 13, and he said, Arlen, why don't you, because I had all these ideas of not doing a text-heavy book. It turns out they use publicity photos. Publicity photos are shots taken by a photographer on the set of The Twilight Zone, but they're not the actual broadcast imagery.
Right.
And I realized I had art book ideas for The Twilight Zone. I learned classic graphic design at Rodin School of Design, descended from the Bauhaus, the German school of design in the 1920s, which is considered, from a graphic design point of view, as the epitome of great graphic design. The expression form follows function comes out of the Bauhaus. So I learned at RISD a concept called the concrete book. What that meant was, as a graphic designer, when you take on a book project, every one of your design choices, from the typography to the size of the book, the look of the book, the feel of the book, the way the pages turn, everything you do should reinforce the subject matter. So if you're doing a book about, let's say, the history of railroads, maybe you'll have type design on the bottom. The page numbers might look like railroad tracks, so that as you go through the book, you'll get a whole railroad track. Well, I applied that to The Twilight Zone. And I said, you know, if I'm going to do a book about The Twilight Zone, it's got to look like The Twilight Zone. It's got to feel like The Twilight Zone. So when this friend of mine said, Arlen, do your own book, I didn't think of myself traditionally as a writer. I saw myself more as a visual artist who also writes. But that put the idea in my mind that, you know what, I can do my own book. Well, that set me on a 10-year odyssey to do this book that eventually was called Visions from the Twilight Zone. And what it was I then set up my camera. I took pictures of all these cool images, and then I set up a tape recorder to every episode. And whenever I heard a line of dialogue or narration that also sounded Twilight Zone-ish, that talked about the philosophy of the Twilight Zone, the middle ground between light and shadow, the dimension of imagination, I thought, so I extracted dialogue and narration And when I transcribed it, it read like poetry to me. So my coffee table book, Visions from the Twilight Zone, is both the television images treated like black and white art photography, and the words and ideas are treated like poetry. So it's certainly not your standard book about television, but The Twilight Zone was not a standard television show. So the book came out in 1990, and Chronicle Books, you know, good publisher, but again, I was a little bit ahead of my time, which is both a blessing and a curse, because it was before the internet, before the Sci-Fi Channel. People interested in television history never knew about my book. But again, if my Silver Age book is successful with the growth of self-publishing, I think my plan is that I'll bring the Visions from the Twilight Zone book back out maybe next year, because believe it or not, next year is the 25th anniversary of my Twilight Zone book. But the director, Brian Singer, out in Hollywood, I read 2 years ago, he optioned the rights for a new Twilight Zone TV series. Leonardo DiCaprio, his production company, licensed the rights to do a feature-length film based on one of the hour-long Twilight Zones. My gut has always told me that everybody loves the Twilight Zone, that today's directors, whether you're talking about Spielberg, George Lucas, David Lynch, you know, 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon? I can do 6 Degrees of Rod Serling, meaning name any current science fiction, fantasy, or horror product put out by Hollywood, and I can connect it to its influence from a Twilight Zone episode in less than 6 degrees of separation. So my gut tells me that if I were to bring my Twilight Zone book back out next year, again, thanks to Facebook and the new internet audience, you know, Netflix started showing the Twilight Zone episodes, you know, streaming them in these last couple of years, and I've noticed a whole rash of new websites of like 30-something guys reviewing the Twilight Zone. So there's a whole new audience that's discovering the Twilight Zone now. You know, there's stations like MeTV that are showing the Twilight Zone again. So it really tells me that, again, people who don't know my book that didn't get in 1990, when I put it in their hands now, they flip. So this tells me the same thing with my Silver Age book. Though it's out of print, when I would take, you know, a book from the original printing and give it to a comic book fan or an historian that's never seen it, they love it. And I think it's the same thing. So that's kind of my plan, is, you know, to go ahead and do that. But my gut tells me the Silver Age book will be successful, and I think my Twilight Zone book will be too.
Now, with everything that you've done, it's always more visual than just the typing. That's what I always found was unique about your approach to it. When you took the pictures from the Twilight Zone off the TV, do you think that could be reproduced now with the way TV is now? Because even the type of TV that you have gives it a different look and a different feel. So do you think it could be done now? Do you think these books could be done as if you started right now as opposed to being done back then?
Well, it's funny you say that. When I did my Twilight Zone book in 1990, I wanted, getting back to that concrete book idea, I wanted the look of the scan lines. I wanted the look, you know, my book is shaped like a small black and white TV set. I wanted the look of the image as it was transmitted to people. So I took images off the screen and kept the scan lines. In the same way with my Silver Age book, you know, the black and white original art to the comics is great and it's beautiful. It's the original art. But that's not the way the art was transmitted to readers. We saw the newsprint comics printed with the Bende dots, those little dots. That's the look I love. So my Silver Age book doesn't recolor the art. It doesn't reprint it in a way that wasn't originally perceived. What I do, I don't go for that look of the yellowed old pages. I try to be more of a color restorer than a recolorist, meaning the original colorist intended the paper to be white. They intended the blacks to be black and the whites to be white. Well, God bless Photoshop. When you scan an original comic book page from the 60s, the original scan gives you that yellowed paper look. But I go into Photoshop and I turn that yellowed color into white as it was originally intended. But yet the dots of the Bende dot printing is still there.
Right.
And it's the same thing with Twilight Zone. I wanted the look of the scan lines. But if I go back and redo the Twilight Zone book, it'll give me a chance to do it digitally. And I think this time, since I've already done the scan line look, I think I might go with the actual frame blow-ups, which I have access to now. And again, because the computer, and you can isolate a frame and get it. I didn't have that, obviously, in 1990 to do that. So it'll still be the look of those great images, but I don't think I'm going to do the scan lines again. I'm going to just give it, it'll be the same content, but it'll be a fresh look. But, you know, I've noticed over the years, people are split. Some people like the scan lines, some people didn't. So, you know, you can't please all the people all the time. In the end, you've got to do what your gut tells you is the right thing. Some people didn't like the Silver Age book when I blew up an image and you can see the dots. Other people loved it. So, you know, you got to just go with what you like.
Yeah, Charlie.
Well, I think, I think what you're saying is absolutely right. But personally, being a fan of the Twilight Zone, personally, when they did the new Twilight Zone one in the 90s,
yeah, horrible.
I was appalled with the opening sequence.
Terrible.
It was terrible. And the only thing that caught my interest was when they did maybe a nanosecond of Rod Serling.
Yeah, they stuck that in.
They stuck that in, and I said, "You idiots! There's some director of graphic arts who was in a meeting, who did the storyboard and made a total waste of time and money, in my opinion."
Well, Charlie,
that opening.
The main thing that they screwed up. Forget about the graphic opening. The shows themselves were filmed in color. And if you know the Twilight Zone, it's the middle ground between light and shadow. It's a black and white concept.
Right.
The Twilight Zone was filmed in black and white, obviously.
Well, obviously.
But it's meant to be in black and white. One of my quotes, I got to interview, when he was alive, the director of photography of the Twilight Zone, George Clemens, happened to be a direct descendant from Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens.
Wow.
And he told me, and it's a quote in my book, there was pressure on Rod Serling in 1963. Color TV was just coming in. The Twilight Zone had low ratings. You know, it was kind of like Star Trek. It never got high ratings. It was a critic's darling. It won Emmys. But it was always in danger of being canceled because it never got high ratings. And the reason why there was the hour-long season was because they canceled the Twilight Zone, and CBS would only agree to bring it back as an hour-long show to see if it would increase the ratings. Well, it didn't, so the Twilight Zone kind of stumbled in its last season as a half-hour show. But the point is Clemens, there was pressure on Serling to turn it into color. It would have been one of the very first color TV shows, but Clemens went to Serling and said, "We can't give you the Twilight Zone feeling in black and in color like we could in black and white."
Yeah.
Now, that's a very intuitive statement. And, of course, the current filmmakers, they did a Twilight Zone syndicated series in 85. Then they tried it again in the 90s. And the bottom line is they have this attitude where, oh, the kids these days, you know, they won't watch black and white. But meanwhile, great videos, award-winning videos. Remember The Boys of Summer? It's now 30 years old. But so many award-winning commercials and videos are done in beautiful black and white. You still see TV commercials now filmed in black and white. So this idea that today's audience won't watch black and white, I think, you know, is bunk.
I think you're absolutely right. I think the diehard science fiction fans will pick up on this. As you said before, and you're absolutely right, I leave the Sci-Fi Channel on all night, and I fall asleep. If I wake up and look at that channel, I can tell if Twilight Zone is on.
Yeah.
I look at that, and I go, well, Twilight Zone, oh, yeah. You know, even though I know the episode, there are some episodes I didn't know, and I looked at it, I said, Twilight Zone.
Right.
So if the color version is on, I go, what the hell is this?
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
And I think if anybody is thinking of doing another one, just again, my opinion, They should go into an old black and white studio, TV studio, and do everything in there.
Charlie, forget that. What they should be doing is hiring me as a creative consultant. Are you kidding me?
That's where I was going with this, okay? That's where I was going.
Well, Charlie, great minds think alike. What can I tell you?
It was like the Beatles.
Yeah.
They recorded in Abbey Road, a four-track recording studio.
Right.
Some of the greatest stuff was put out. People over the years are trying to get that feel, and they're just losing it. Go back to Abbey Road and record on the four-track studio. You'll get the feel again.
Right.
You know?
I think Tom Petty's new album, I think he recorded it analog, possibly. I'm not sure, but I know that. Look at the growth of the rebirth of vinyl, with this idea that a vinyl record gives it a certain warmness and a totality of sound that audiophiles will tell you don't get on CDs, on discs. It's more shrill. So I really think, again, I don't know what the new TV series with Bryan Singer is going to do. I don't know if DiCaprio, these are things I heard about a couple years ago. I haven't heard anything since, so you never know with Hollywood whether they're going to follow through with these things. But the point is the Twilight Zone, the original TV series, is a bona fide classic. God bless Netflix for turning on a whole new audience. You know, you mentioned the Sci-Fi channel. I'm a little kind of PO'd with them because they should be treating the Twilight Zone as the science fiction classic and running it every night in prime time.
Whoa.
And again, if they hired me, as the son Rod Serling never had, to actually MC the shows and introduce them. You know, like on, what is that, Turner Classic Movies?
Yeah,
they've got that guy, Robert, whatever his name is. I could be doing that for the Twilight Zone. And in fact, if you go to my website and you click on, there's a Twilight Zone icon, you'll see the wealth of art projects I've done with the Twilight Zone, audio mashups of the music with the words and the dialogue and essays. I mean, I have a whole syllabus for teaching the Twilight Zone. It's called The Five Themes of the Twilight Zone. So I've done enough work on the Twilight Zone that I should be granted like an honorary degree in pop culture, which, by the way, Bowling Green University has a degree in pop culture. So I'm waiting for my phone to ring, you know?
And I want to add one thing to that. If you do get the amazing honor of introducing the series of the Twilight Zone,
your mouth to God's ears, Charlie.
Go to Hughes cameras. Go remember the Hughes Sport Network, and they had the old black and white cameras.
Yeah,
make them use that when they film you introducing the shows.
Well, it would be so nice to get to that point where you know I can exercise that kind of creative control. But we'll see, you know. Everything's possible. You never know who might be listening, you know, tonight that would, you know, be able to make that happen. So,
it's possible. You can always get a small spot on a very, not too watched station and build it up from that alone.
Of course. I keep all my options open as a freelance artist. You never know, what's going to happen and what's going to come through.
I know, but you're absolutely right. I'm all for what you're saying about the Twilight Zone. I think these new artists come out and they proceed to tell you what you want, and it's their own vision, which is fine. Everybody should have a vision. But don't fool around with things when they work.
And by the way, my interests in the Twilight Zone and comic books overlap. I've done a lecture called Comic Books and the Twilight Zone because so many of the great Twilight Zone episodes were uncredited adaptations of the EC science fiction stories from the early 50s. And Serling was an avid reader of science fiction, according to his widow. And then in turn, the Twilight Zone episodes influenced Stan Lee and Steve Ditko, who were doing these little five-page stories in the early pre-superhero Marvel comics that were kind of Twilight Zone knockoffs. And in the last issue of this comic they were doing called Amazing Fantasy, they featured a kind of Twilight Zone story that ended up being a superhero about a kid that gets powers, but he doesn't use them to help people. He uses them selfishly. And that story, of course, is the story of Spider-Man. Spider-Man is built on irony. You know, the DC Comics superheroes, they got their powers magically or by being hit by a, you know, lightning bolt or, you know, Superman's an alien. But their immediate instinct was, oh, I'll go fight crime. Spider-Man is built on irony. The fact that he didn't use his powers to save Uncle Ben, that's what makes him fight crime. Right. And that is irony right out of, as Rod Serling would say, file it under I for irony. In the Twilight Zone. So there is a relationship. And in my Silver Age book, in the Steve Ditko, he's the artist who co-created Spider-Man with Stan Lee, designed that incredible costume, maybe the most creative costume in comics history, I actually show Twilight Zone episode images that look like Steve Ditko's art and vice versa, because he drew kind of the everyman. You know, Peter Parker was what we would call a nerd. Ditko's style was not like Jack Kirby, this super strong, you know, hyper-exaggerated visualization. Right. That's why Stan Lee wanted Ditko to draw Spider-Man. He didn't want that big, bulky Kirby character. So Ditko's people were kind of everyday, ordinary, even ugly. And I contrast them and compare them to Twilight Zone images. And when I do my lectures, I dissolve one over the other and people usually gasp when they see it at how close the relationship is. So I found a way to relate my interests because they do overlap.
Okay, so for the junior member in this panel, I need to ask, what is the feel of Twilight Zone? Because both of you, Arlen and Charlie, both said that it has a unique feel to it. Can you elaborate on what the feel of the Twilight Zone is?
Well, you got to remember, Serling described it as the dimension of imagination. When I did my research in the Twilight Zone, you know, we throw around the word surreal. Thanks to Salvador Dali, surrealism has become very kind of popular. It's a pop culture buzzword. Oh, that's surreal. This is surreal. But when something happens in your life that is surreal, people go do-do-do-do-do, you know, they hum the Twilight Zone music. Well, I did my research in surrealism for the Twilight Zone book. The surrealists, the word surreal is French. It means sur, on top of reality. They wanted people to step back from their reality and look at it with fresh eyes. When something happens in your life that is like that, when you get that out-of-body experience, that is a Twilight Zone experience. But if the original surrealists from the 1920s in Europe were to look in a crystal ball and see Rod Serling in the Twilight Zone, they would have accepted Serling as one of their own. The word enchanté in French, enchanter, means an artist of madness. So this idea of the Twilight Zone, of people in regular people who find themselves in these bizarre, surreal, extraordinary situations, that is surreality on television. You know, when people talk about Twilight Zone, they'll say, oh, it was a science fiction show. Well, there were, of course, some great science fiction stories, but that wasn't all what the Twilight Zone is about. It wasn't a pure fantasy show, because the Twilight Zone was grounded in the reality of its day.
I was just going to say that. It could happen. It's one of those things that they made it so that they're ordinary people, and this could happen, you know?
Right, right. With that little bit of the suspension of disbelief. But when I talk about reality, Serling was very socially conscious and aware. In the fall of 1963, the debut episode of that season's Twilight Zone was with Jack Klugman in an episode called In Praise of Pip. His son is over in Vietnam. It's the first mention of Vietnam, not in a nonfiction news setting, in a dramatic television show. The first time in September of 63, Klugman is looking at the camera and goes, my son is dying in a place called South Vietnam. There isn't even supposed to be a war going on there.
Wow.
Groundbreaking. Wow, yeah. Serling cast in 1960, the first black actor in a dramatic role, Ivan Dixon, who was later the black guy in Hogan's Heroes. That was Ivan Dixon. Serling cast women in dramatic roles as single women, not as married women, when every woman on TV was either a Lucille Ball, you know, comedian, screwball, or a Donna Reed housewife. So Serling, like all great art, was both of his time and ahead of his time. And great art has to speak to not only the time it was created, but be timeless. And I think The Twilight Zone, and this is what my essays are about and what my book is about, is so much of that. And the same thing with my Silver Age book, that even though this art and these characters that Hollywood's making movies out of are 50 years old, they're still relevant. You know, they're doing a new Flash TV series. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, shooting a guy running fast in live action to me has always looked a little goofy. When they do it real fast, a guy running fast, it's like Keystone Cops. It looks a little goofy. When you slow-mo it, it looks a little weird. The best visualization of a guy running fast is on the two-dimensional page by Carmine Infantino. By the way, you got to love that name, Carmine, which means red, and the Flash was that red-suited character. So, I mean, you can't make this stuff up. But his visualization of the Flash on the two-dimensional page with those strobing speed lines is a graphic device that's never been duplicated and are now graphic standards. In the same way Jack Kirby, when he shows energy, it's called by fans Kirby Crackle. And yet, he got that out of the first photograph of a quasar from outer space in 1965, reprinted in National Geographic, because Kirby was an avid reader of magazines like that, Popular Mechanics, stuff like that. Those dots that he saw in the photograph, he duplicated on the comic book page. His Kirby Crackle has become graphic standards for generations of comic artists. And this is all, you know, part of my lectures and part of what my book is about, is treating these comic artists like these great American artists of the human figure. You know, the way we look back on the Renaissance masters of the human figure 500 years ago, like Michelangelo and Raphael and Da Vinci, I really believe 500 years from now, future art historians, or maybe aliens, are going to look back at guys like Joe Kubert and Neil Adams and Jack Kirby as our Renaissance masters of the human figure. And hopefully they'll be looking at my book as one of the reasons for making it happen.
All right. So this is something that we brought up last week. We had an artist on, Ron Garney. He was a guest on it.
I know his work, Ron Garney, yeah.
And it kind of came up a conversation about recognition. And I know this is a big deal. And for someone, especially in the Silver Age, this is incredibly important. What do you think about recognition for the artists as to should they get something, should they not get something? I mean, you know, it's a contract for hire. What is your opinion just based on the large amount of work you've researched?
Yeah. Well, I find it really sad that all these artists now in my book have all pretty much died off. Neil Adams and Jim Steranko were the Young Turks back then. They're in their mid-70s now. The only one left alive is Steve Ditko, but he's like the J.D. Salinger, Greta Garbo of comics. He ain't talking to, you know, the press and getting his picture taken. I've kind of taken it upon myself, and there are some other people out there. I really feel like, where is the Kennedy Center honors for Jack Kirby? You know, I have in my files testimonials from policemen and firemen who became policemen and firemen because of the superhero comics they read as kids. You know, I was interviewed by ABC 2020 a couple of years ago. They did a special called Superhumans, which was all about people doing superhuman feats in real life that are very super heroic. You know, a guy that runs a marathon every day for 25 days in a row. So they hired me to do the graphics, and then they also interviewed me for the show. And during the interview, the producer said, Arlen, what do these superpowers like represent? What do they mean? And I thought to myself, off the top of my head, I say, you know, the real superpower is the power of love. It's the love that these superheroes have for the people they're protecting, the earth that they're saving, whatever it is. And love, as we all know, the Beatles said it, all you need is love. You know, love is the greatest power. And when I said this to him in the interview, I'm looking at him and his eyes start tearing. But I had to keep talking. I couldn't, you know. Anyway, when the interview was done, the cameraman and the lighting guy pulled me aside and they said, you know, Arlen, we've been working with this producer for 30 years. Nobody's ever made him cry. And I said to him, well, you know, that better wind up in the show. Of course, it didn't make it. You know, now every actor that says my best scenes are on the cutting room floor, I know what they mean. But what I'm trying to say is that I would have a Kennedy Center Honors for Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko and all these great guys, because they are great American artists that have changed lives. You know, most artists making a living, at least in the comic book field, are because of these comics. But movie directors, James Cameron is a comic book guy. Sam Raimi, you know, he insisted in those first Spider-Man movies that even though Steve Ditko was a work-for-hire freelancer and doesn't own Spider-Man, he insisted that if they wanted him to direct the Spider-Man movie, Ditko's name would have to be on the credits. And unless it's an urban legend, that's why Ditko's name is on there. But it saddens me that a person seeing the Captain America movie.
Right.
Jack Kirby's name is typeset the same size as the key grips. And they don't know that just the act of Captain America throwing his shield like a discus as a weapon comes out of the artist's imagination. Stan Lee, you know, to get off on a little tangent, has gotten far too much credit as the writer for the creation of these characters. But remember what I said, comics are a visual medium. Nobody cares who wrote The Flash. It's that Carmen Infantino drew it in such a way that when people think of The Flash, they're thinking of that Infantino strobe line image. When you think of Thor and the Fantastic Four and the Avengers, it's Jack Kirby's imagination that made these characters live. And listen, it ain't over till it's over. If I have my way, maybe one day there will be a Kennedy Center Honors, and I'll be the guy on stage creating, you know, the visual honors and talking about these things. That's another goal of mine that I hope to achieve. But yeah, the artists, ironically, in such a visual medium, have been kind of lost in the shuffle of the mainstream cultures globbing on of these characters, and yet they're visual icons. You know, it kind of bugs me that characters like Hawkeye in the Avengers movie doesn't have that incredible purple medieval outfit. You know, they don't realize that these are not real people. They're superheroes. And the superhero is all about the costume and the design. You know, when they did the last Spider-Man movie, I wanted to see Electro in that green and yellow. Like, you know, one thing, you know, Zack Snyder has gotten knocked a lot by the comic fans. But if you look at Watchmen, one of the things that I love about Snyder's visual imagination is that he understands the visual nature of these characters. Dr. Manhattan in The Watchmen looked like a Dave Gibbons drawing come to life.
Yes, he did a very well job.
His Night Owl looked like a better Batman than those stupid Dark Knight movies. Don't even get me started. We can fill up a whole hour on why I hate what Batman looks like as a live-action character. They've still never done him right.
But the problem is the world is they want realism. They want it to be quote-unquote real.
Right.
And as you said to yourself, certain things don't translate from the 2D to a 3D image. So they have to have
But look at Spider-Man. Spider-Man looks like the comic character, thanks to Sam Raimi. He moved and, you know, swung through those buildings like the Steve Ditko Spider-Man come to life. The first Superman movie by Chris Reeve, he's in a costume. People love that movie because they treated it seriously. And yes, you have to suspend your disbelief in a guy running around in a costume. But this idea of making Batman in this molded rubber Michelin Man outfit because, oh, a real guy, you know, wouldn't go around getting hit by bullets. Well, you know, I don't buy that. And funny, I mentioned Bryan Singer. The reason why the original X-Men were in those black leather costumes is that he had a bias, that famous quote, I don't think people will believe spandex.
Yeah, yellow spandex.
But I think he's wrong because it you can do it well. And again, the first Superman movie and the Spider-Man movies, Spider-Man looks more like Spider-Man in the comics than the Batman of the Dark Knight films looks like the Batman in the comics. And that really, as an artist, really bothers me.
All right, so we have less than 5 minutes because I know you love taking a whole chunk of time.
Stop me when you've heard enough. You know, turn me off. There is no off switch.
Charlie, did you have a question for him before I go on to the next one?
No, I just have a request for him.
Go ahead.
I would like him to write a book, and I would like that title, that book, And the title of the book I want him to write would be Submitted for Your Approval, The Genius of Rod Serling.
Serling! Not Sterling. Charlie, turn in your Twilight Zone card. How dare you?
That's his accent. It just
sounds I'm all the way in St. James. You heard it wrong.
Where did we go? I'm going to say this because I know Charlie hates reality shows. So where did we go wrong from a show that's surreal all the way to a reality show that's not even close to being real? How do we get from there to here? What went wrong, and can that be changed?
Well,
because the world is full of idiots who buy into that stuff.
Well, I think when you talk about television, you know, it comes to economics. Reality shows were far cheaper to be created, and then when the ratings were high, 2 + 2 = 4.
So it's all about money? Is that the...
Well, hello? Hello? Oh, yeah, I mean, economics also create art as well. You know, whether you go back to Gutenberg and the printing press, you know, whenever there's an economic change, artists take advantage of it and follow it. So a lot of times, great art is produced because of economics and, you know, and vice versa. So, yeah, that, you know, that happens. But listen, there's still great TV. 90%, according to Sturgeon's Law, 90% of everything is junk. It's our job as people who care about quality to seek out the 10% that's good in any medium. Right now, 90% of the movies out there probably suck, but 10% of them are great. 90% of television is bad, but there's 10%. I mean, Ray Donovan airing tonight. I'm a big fan of that show. So there's always, and same thing in comics, you know, maybe 90% of them are junk, but 10% are great. So I think that goes for pretty much everything, and that's still being produced, and it's our job to seek out that 10%.
So speaking of the 10%, where can they find your stuff?
Well, if they want my Silver Age book right now, they should go to my Facebook group, The Silver Age of Comic Book Art, and become a member of that group because they could sign up for a reserved, signed, and drawn-in hardcover. And then the publisher, Archway Publications, I think it's archwaypublishers.com or archwaypublications.com. Let me just see what their website is. I think it's archwaypublishing.com.
Publishing.com.
Right. If they don't want to get the signed hardcover, they can get the hardcover. But more importantly, they can get the ebook through Archway Publishing. My website is eventually going to have all this information as well. ArlenSchumer.com, ARLEN. SCH, like Chuck Schumer, the center of New York, although we're not related. Although, you know what? We might be related when it comes to Eastern European Jews. You know, who knows what was going on back then? Maybe we are. I mean, how many Schumers can there be? Amy Schumer, the comedian. Maybe we are related. But yeah, between the Silver Age of Comic Book Art Facebook group, they can Facebook friend me, my own personal page, but join that group and the discussion we're getting, the images that we're getting on the group are really great for anybody that loves comic book art history. And archwaypublishing.com and my own website, between all of those things, you should have no problem.
And are you going to be at a convention?
Yeah, next month my book is going to debut at the Jacob Javits Center, the New York Comic Convention, October 9th through 12th. And on that Sunday, the 12th, I will be lecturing at the Jacob Javits Center about the Silver Age. And then the very next day, on the 13th, Columbus Day, I'll be in New York City at this very kind of groovy downtown club called Bowery Arts and Science. And it just really came through the other day. But that will be, limited seating. But I'll be doing my Silver Age lecture there. And I think the tickets are $10, but I'll be discounting the book from 50 to 40. So if they come and get a seat there, they can also get a book. So the information for that, go to Bowery Arts and Science, spell out the word and, .org, and I think all the information will be there. And this week I'll be getting that up on my website. New York Comic Convention, I think the tickets are sold out, so if you can't get in there, come to see me at Bowery Arts and Science. And if all goes well during the rest of the fall and winter, I will be scheduling other events and book signings that I will be posting on my website that people can go to.
So we are down to about a minute and a half. Charlie, final thought?
No, I just had a very interesting hour with this gentleman. I just enjoyed See? I enjoyed his chatting with him, and I like his ideas a lot.
Thank you, Charlie. Right back at you, man.
That's what I'm saying. Arlen needed the whole hour. I told him, I was like, you know,
and it's still not enough.
I know. I was like, come down here. We'll give you a whole hour because you have so much to say and so much more to say. If we were 2 hours, we would be still going on.
Stop me when you've heard it.
Thank you, Arlen, for coming down. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Mark. It's been great.
So that about does it for this week on It Came From The Radio. Join us right here.
Does it really, Mark?
Yes, it does. Join us right here and every week on WGBB. If you miss any part of the show, you can go on to our website, www.itcamefromtheradio.com. Listen to the archives, which will be up in a couple of days. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at ICTFR. And we will see you next week.
Next week.
You have been listening to It Came From The Radio with Mark Torres. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests did not necessarily reflect the views of WGBB, the owners, or staff. And now we return you to your earthly scheduled broadcast.
In the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.